You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
Trade deficit is too large.
We must not go back to unwise spending.
This is America.
Madison, of course, the main framer, he argued that, he didn't put it in these terms, but he argued basically that democracy is a bad thing. It's dangerous. We have to make sure that the public doesn't become involved in public affairs. So there should be a democratic deficit. And he had a good argument. The model that he had in mind was England, of course. And he said, suppose that in England there was a functioning democracy. Well, then the large majority of the population would use their voting power to carry out what we would call land reform, to take land from the rich who concentrate it in their hands and distribute it themselves, mostly in agrarian society. And he said that obviously would be unfair. It would be taking away property from the rich. So we can't accept that. He was actually raising a question that goes back to the first serious work on politics, Aristotle's book, Politics. Aristotle faced exactly the same question. I don't know if Madison was conscious of this or not. Aristotle considered the various kinds of political systems and their merits and deficiencies and decided that the least bad, he didn't like any of them, the least bad was democracy. But he noticed that there's a problem, namely Madison's problem. He was talking about Athens, if the poor in Athens could use their voting power, they would take property away from the wealthy, and that's unfair. So they were asking the same question, but they came to opposite conclusions. Aristotle's conclusion was you should get rid of inequality. And he outlined what we would call a welfare state, measures that could be used in Athens to eliminate inequality, so you wouldn't face the problem of the poor using their voting power to take property from the rich. Madison came to the opposite conclusion. He said what you have to do is eliminate democracy. That'll get rid of the problem. So the system that he designed places power primarily in the hands of the Senate, which is the most remote from the population of the various branches of government that were outlined in the Constitution. And he said the Senate should be the wealth of the nation, the more responsible set of men, those who have respect for property owners and their rights. And the population should kind of be fragmented and marginalized. And that way the government can meet its obligation, in his words, to protect the minority of the opulent from the majority. And that's essentially the Madisonian compact, and it persists to the present. In fact, a good bit of the history of the last couple hundred years is the struggle between these two answers, Aristotle's answer and Madison's answer. right to the present. In fact, we have a huge industry in the United States. It's called the public relations industry, which is founded explicitly on the Madisonian principle. Its founder, leading figure, Edward Bernays, back in the 1920s, expressed the same view. He said that a power should be in the hands of the intelligent minority, and in order to achieve that, keep the public out of it, we have to carry out what he called engineering of consent, and that's the task of the public relations industry. He didn't explain how the intelligent minority gained that privilege, but the answer's not very difficult to figure out. By serving power, that makes you the intelligent minority, and then you can manage the society for their interests, following Adam Smith's principle.
I know what you're trying to do.
I'm trying to free your mind, Neo, but I can only show you the door. You're the one that has to walk through it.
Some say I need a driver, a Nixon mask and gun. But let me tell you, brothers and sisters, that's not how you get a bank job done. You can't walk in there brazen with a newsie like Patty Hearst. I'm gonna secure myself a seat on the board of directors first. Oh, that's how you rob a bank. I'll get some decent suits and a bogus business plan. Become well versed in the etiquette of Wall Street Disneyland. Hit the country clubs, eating peanuts and drinking scotch. Talk the recent trends and fart into a velvet couch.
Well, what about the banks and the investment firms? They're just as delighted as the insurance companies. And again, the business press expresses it better than I can, so I'll just mostly quote. You see headlines in the, say, the New York Times, in flurry of big merger deals, signs of restored confidence. Investors eager to take risky investments. The profits and bonuses are kind of off the chart. And in fact, why shouldn't they take risky investments? They're not risky. They've got a government insurance policy. There's a huge public bailout, no meaningful regulation, and there's a very significant increase taking place in the government insurance policy for risky investments and loans. It has a name, which you know, it's called too big to fail. If you're too big to fail, you get a government insurance policy. Well, bank has an insurance policy, sure, investment firm will take risky loans, risky investments, and make a lot of money. And if anything goes wrong, you pay for it. So, yeah, now it's more extreme than it was before the financial crisis. One of the really good economic correspondents, Gretchen Morgenstern of the New York Times, says too big to fail is just too big to take on. Deal with that. You're getting too close to the centers of power. So here's the Washington Post, which says it a lot better than I can, so I'll read it. It says, headline, banks too big to fail have grown even bigger. Behemoths born of the bailout reduce consumer choice, tempt corporate moral hazard. When the credit crisis struck last year, federal regulators pumped tens of billions of dollars into the nation's leading financial institutions. Today, the biggest of these banks are even bigger. The crisis may be turning out very well for the behemoths that dominate U.S. finance. A series of federally arranged mergers safely landed troubled banks on the decks of more stable firms, and it allowed the survivors to emerge from the turmoil with strengthened market positions, giving them even greater control over consumer lending and more potential to profit. These mergers were largely the government's making. Regulators pushed failing mortgage lenders and Wall Street firms into the arms of even bigger banks and handed out billions of dollars to ensure that the deals would go through. The oligopoly has tightened. It's only in economics departments that they talk about free markets, not in the real world.
know what I'm talking about?
The Matrix.
Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window, or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
George Orwell once wrote that the great enemy of clear language is insincerity. When there is a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns, as it were, instinctively to long words and exhausted idioms like a cuttlefish spurting out ink. You've probably heard confusing phrases like the trade deficit, the falling dollar, the national debt, unfunded liabilities, and so on, which all sound vague and actuarial and vaguely, well, not me. The reality behind these accounting phrases is perfectly monstrous. When someone, a foreigner say, loans money to the American government, what are they getting in return? Well, they are getting promises of interest payments and eventual repayment of the principal. Where does your government get this money? The government is not a business. It does not generate profits in the free market. So where does it get the money to repay its creditors? Are you beginning to understand that it is not dollars that are being sold, or bonds, or agency debt, or treasuries, or anything like that? Where is your government going to get the money to pay off its creditors? It's not pieces of paper, or contracts, or computer bits that are being sold. There is only one thing that the government has to sell. Governments have only one asset that they can use as collateral. Your leaders are selling you. When China lends $800 billion to your government, what they get in return is a guarantee that $10,000 plus interest will be taken from your family at gunpoint and shipped overseas. When a farmer gets a loan from a bank, he uses his livestock as collateral. It is the milk and meat his cows will produce in the future that he will use to pay off his loan. The bank is buying a share in his cows. You are the livestock that your leaders use as collateral. The leaders that you cheer for and throw parades for and drop balloons behind and donate money to are selling you to Chinese rulers, to the Japanese, to the Nigerians, to South American drug lords with accounts in the Caribbean banking centers, to Russia, to Korea, to Egypt, to Colombia, to Chile, to the Philippines, to Malaysia, and anyone else who is willing to give them a few dollars in return for the blood, sweat, and toil of your future. The flag that you praise and the anthems that you sing and the rulers that you weep and kneel before have as much loyalty to you as a plantation owner had to his slaves. And sadly, plantation slaves had more pride than we do. Plantation slaves did not generally praise their masters for selling them off, for auctioning off the lives, hopes, dreams, and futures of their own little children. We can understand that cattle may lick the hand of the farmer who lowers an axe to its neck, because cattle are dumb beasts that cannot comprehend their real relationship with the farmer and his imminent plans for them. What is our excuse? When we chant, USA, 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 when we cheer and bow and beg and scrape and sing and weep with joy that some new farmer now presides over the wholesale dismantling and sale of our family's futures, when we love with obsessive emptiness the leaders who laugh while they auction us off to every tin pot dictator and stockbroker the world over, what is our excuse? Has our pride been so broken that we lunge with pathetic joy at every new silver-tongued demagogue who pretends to care for us even a tiny little bit. In the future, our children will demand to know why we knelt and cheered as they were sold off on the auctioneer's block.
The United States has been attacked by a well-organized economic elite who are tactically destroying our way of life. They have paid off leaders of both the Republican and Democratic parties. They have seized control of the U.S. government, the U.S. Treasury, our tax system, the Federal Reserve, the stock market, and the U.S. and global economy. We no longer live in a society with a functioning free market. What we have now is a rigged market, and with that, a rigged government. The harsh truth is that the United States government has facilitated the theft of trillions of dollars of national wealth, and 99% of the U.S. population no longer has political representation. This sounds extreme. But I assure you that the evidence is now overwhelming. Current statistical societal indicators clearly demonstrate that a strategic attack has been launched, and an analysis of current governmental policies prove that conditions for 99% of the American population will continue to deteriorate. The economic elite have engineered a financial coup d'etat and have brought war to our doorstep. And make no mistake, they have launched an all-out economic war to eliminate the very existence of a U.S. economic middle class. Life is good at Halliburton. If you're really so astute, you should invest in Brown & Root. unless we all urgently unite and organize on common ground and form a massive nonviolent movement, our very way of life and the ideals that our country was founded upon will continue to unravel at an increasing rate. I'm not exaggerating in any way when I say in the history of the United States, the stakes have never been higher. The unprecedented transfer of wealth and staggering level of theft continues unabated. As I'm watching this unfold, I am horrified thinking about the severe consequences that have only just begun to reap their toll. Our nation is being raped and pillaged before our eyes.
Obama picked to fix up the economic crisis. First person he picked was Robert Rubin, the senior advisor. He was Secretary of Treasury under Clinton. His great achievement was to dismantle the Glass-Steagall Act, New Deal legislation that protected commercial banks from risky investments. So he broke that barrier. He quickly left the Treasury Department, joined Citigroup, became a director. Citigroup made use of these new opportunities to make a ton of money. It's what happens when you make risky loans guaranteed by the government. It crashed. Rubin took off with his gains and became Obama's chief economic advisor, the one who laid out the program for him. The next person Obama picked was Lawrence Summers, who followed an economist who followed Rubin as Secretary of Treasury, and his great achievement was to block any regulation of exotic financial instruments, derivatives. It's another factor that drove the economy into disaster. So he's the next in line. And the next is Timothy Geithner, who was head of the New York Fed, which supervised. That's where all these things happen, and he was sort of on the scene supervising the financial crisis and meltdown, so he's the next. And so it goes. Actually, the business press had an interesting rundown on this. Bloomberg News, one of the main business journals, did an article where the reporter just went through the, I think it was 17 people who Obama called in when he came into office to, you know, figure out how to deal with the crisis, including these. And they went through each one and their records, and the conclusion was that these guys shouldn't be meeting to fix the economy. They should be in court facing subpoenas because of the... financial manipulations, the accounting tricks, robbery, and so on. Well, that's the business press. But it, you know, makes sense. Well, take a look at the campaign and remember Tom Ferguson's thesis. Who are Obama's funders? Well, concentration of funding, the heaviest concentration, was in the financial institutions. They preferred him to McCain. They figured he'd do a better job for them. And in fact, that probably swung the election if you take a look at the details in the swing states. So, the standard theses work out. You buy the election. You get your policies implemented.
You are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage. Born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
This is the story of your enslavement, how it came to be, and how you can finally be free. Like all animals, human beings want to dominate and exploit the resources around them. At first, we mostly hunted and fished and ate off the land, but then something magical and terrible happened to our minds. We became, alone among the animals, afraid of death and of future loss. And this was the start of a great tragedy and an even greater possibility. You see, when we become afraid of death, of injury and imprisonment, we become controllable and so valuable in a way that no other resource could ever be. The greatest resource for any human being to control is not natural resources or tools or animals or land, but other human beings. You can frighten an animal because animals are afraid of pain in the moment, but you cannot frighten an animal with a loss of liberty, with torture or imprisonment in the future, because animals have very little sense of tomorrow. You cannot threaten a cow with torture or a sheep with death. You cannot swing a sword at a tree and scream at it to produce more fruit, or hold a burning torch to a field and demand more wheat. You cannot get more eggs by threatening a hen, but you can get a man to give you his eggs by threatening him. This human farming has been the most profitable and destructive occupation throughout history, and it is now reaching its destructive climax. Human society cannot be rationally understood until it is seen for what it is: a series of farms where human farmers own human livestock. Some people get confused because governments provide healthcare and water and education and roads, and thus imagine that there is some benevolence at work. Nothing could be further from the reality. Farmers provide healthcare and irrigation and training to their livestock. Some people get confused because we are allowed certain liberties and thus imagine that our governments protect our freedoms. But farmers plant their crops a certain distance apart to increase their yields and will allow certain animals larger stalls or fields if it means they will produce more meat and milk. In your country, your tax farm, your farmer grants you certain freedoms, not because he cares about your liberties
but because he wants to increase his profits. Are you beginning to see the nature of the cage you were born into? There have been four major phases of human farming. The first phase in ancient Egypt was direct and brutal human compulsion. Human bodies were controlled, but the creative productivity of the human mind remained beyond the reach of the whip, of the brand, of the shackles. Slaves remained woefully underproductive and required enormous resources to control. The second phase was the Roman model, wherein slaves were granted some capacity for freedom, ingenuity, and creativity, which raised their productivity. This increased the wealth of Rome, and thus the tax income of the Roman government, and with this additional wealth, Rome became an empire, destroying the economic freedoms that fed its power and collapsed. I'm sure that this does not seem entirely unfamiliar. After the collapse of Rome, the feudal model introduced the concept of livestock ownership and taxation. Instead of being directly owned, peasants farmed land that they could retain as long as they paid off the local warlords. This model eventually broke down due to the continual subdivision of productive land and was destroyed during the enclosure movement when land was consolidated and hundreds of thousands of peasants were kicked off their ancestral lands because new farming techniques made larger farms more productive with fewer people. The increased productivity of the later Middle Ages created the excess food required for the expansion of towns and cities, which in turn gave rise to the modern democratic model of human ownership. As displaced peasants flooded into the cities, a huge stock of cheap human capital became available to the rising industrialists, and the ruling class of human farmers quickly realized that they could make more money by letting their livestock choose their own occupations. Under the democratic model, direct slave ownership has been replaced by the mafia model. The mafia rarely owns businesses directly, but rather sends thugs around once a month to steal from the business owners. You are now allowed to choose your own occupation, which raises your productivity, and thus the taxes you can pay to your masters.
Value this time in your life, kids. Because this is the time in your life when you still have your choices. And it goes by so fast. When you're a teenager, you think you can do anything, and you do. Your 20s are a blur. 30s, you raise your family, you make a little money, and you think to yourself, what happened to my 20s? 40s, you grow a little pot belly, you grow another chin. The music starts to get too loud. One of your old girlfriends from high school becomes a grandmother. 50s, you have a minor surgery. You'll call it a procedure, but it's a surgery. 60s, you'll have a major surgery. The music is still loud, but it doesn't matter because you can't hear it anyway. 70s, you and the wife retire to Fort Lauderdale. You start eating dinner at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You have lunch around 10, breakfast the night before. Spend most of your time wandering around malls looking for the ultimate soft yogurt and muttering, how come the kids don't call? How come the kids don't call? The 80s, you'll have a major stroke. You end up babbling to some Jamaican nurse who your wife can't stand, but who you call mama. Any questions?
Your few freedoms are preserved because they are profitable to your owners. The great challenge of the democratic model is that increases in wealth and freedom threaten the farmers. The ruling classes initially profit from a relatively free market in capital and labor, but as their livestock become more used to their freedoms and growing wealth, they begin to question why they need rulers at all. Ah well, nobody ever said that human farming was easy. Keeping the tax livestock securely in the compounds of the ruling classes is a three-phase process. The first is to indoctrinate the young through government, quote, education. As the wealth of democratic countries grew, government schools were universally inflicted in order to control the thoughts and souls of the livestock. The second phase is to turn citizens against each other through the creation of dependent livestock. It is very difficult to rule human beings directly through force, and where it can be achieved, it remains cripplingly underproductive, as can be seen in North Korea. Human beings do not breed well or produce efficiently in direct captivity. Ah, but if human beings believe that they are free, then they will produce much more for their farmers. The best way to maintain this illusion of freedom is to put some of the livestock on the payroll of the farmer. Those cows that become dependent on the existing hierarchy will then attack any other cows who point out the violence, hypocrisy, and immorality of human ownership.
Officers positioned Grant face first on the floor with one officer near his head, a second near his back, and a third officer standing nearby. There appeared to be a brief struggle. Then, a two-year veteran BART officer stands, draws his weapon, and fires.
Freedom is slavery, and slavery is freedom. If you can get the cows to attack each other whenever anybody brings up the reality of their situation, then you don't have to spend nearly as much controlling them directly. Those cows who become dependent upon the stolen largesse of the farmer will violently oppose any questioning of the virtue of human ownership, and the intellectual and artistic classes, always and forever dependent upon the farmers, will say to anyone who demands freedom from ownership, "You will harm your fellow cows." The livestock are thus kept enclosed. By shifting the moral responsibility for the destructiveness of the violent system to those who demand real freedom. The third phase is to invent continual external threats so that the frightened livestock cling to the protection of the farmers. This system of human farming is now nearing its end. The terrible tragedies of modern Western economic systems has occurred not in spite of, but because of, past economic freedoms. The massive increases in Western wealth throughout the 19th century resulted from economic freedoms. And it was this very increase in wealth that fed the size and power of the state. Whenever the livestock become exponentially more productive, you get a corresponding increase in the number of farmers and their dependents. The growth of the state is always proportional to the preceding economic freedoms. Economic freedoms create wealth, and the wealth attracts more thieves and political parasites, whose greed then destroys the economic freedoms. In other words, freedom metastasizes the cancer of the state. The government that starts off the smallest will always end up the largest. This is why there can be no viable and sustainable alternative to a truly free and peaceful society. A society without political rulers, without human ownership, without the violence of taxation and statism. To be truly free is both very easy and very hard. We avoid the horror of our enslavement because it is so painful to see it directly. We dance around the endless violence of our dying system because we fear the attacks of our fellow livestock. But we can only be kept in the cages we refuse to see. Wake up. To see the farm is to leave it.
Well, Adam Smith, he gave us this myth about how the market will self-regulate. But elite business schemes would still just be dreams without the arms of the state. If you wanna know what they mean when they say we're gonna open up your markets for our free trade, just ask the ghosts of all those who've been killed for refusing to bow down before the dollar bill. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one a $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will. McDonald's requires McDonnell Douglas. United Fruit needed U.S. Marines. The freedom of their market, supported by fascist regimes. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one a $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will. The rhetoric is so thick as they tell us we're free, and we've gotta cut right through their lies. It's not freedom to choose our own destinies, it's freedom to choose our demise. You can die for their money, you can die by their guns. They'll let you choose your own fate. If you get in the way of their profits, you can be sure you'll be burned at the stake. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one a $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will.
They opened fire on the people, and they were
This is CBC Radio.
The massacre of 100
We don't need no great hand coming down from the sky, or your soldiers in olive drab marching on by. To discipline, regulate, liberalize, legislate, we decline. Without you, we were just doing fine. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle,
From below. But the elites who we're talking about have an opposite goal, naturally, that they want to undermine democracy from above. And that's perfectly natural and it's general, shouldn't be surprising. The U.S. may be a little different from similar societies in this respect. It is unusual in the strength of business rule. The United States happens to have a highly class-conscious business community, which is committed to fighting a continuous and very bitter class war. They're not secret about it. Read it in business publications. They're concerned with what they call the hazard-facing industrialists and the rising political power of the masses, and they have to crush that somehow. And there are many ways. At one extreme, just violence. The United States has an unusually violent labor history in comparative terms compared with similar societies. The softer end, there are things like the commitments of the public relations industry, fabricating consumers, directing people to the what are called the superficial things of life, like fashionable consumption and debt traps and other devices. And there's a wide range of devices. They're used with dedication, consciousness, a kind of a vulgar Marxism, just values inverted. And that's a good part of our history up to the present.
I am the problem. How shall we get rid of or marginalize the competitor? All shells compete with thy siblings and thy peers, and compete with classmates for higher marks. All shells compete to be better than other families and groups. All shells compete as a school against other schools for funding. All shells compete for jobs and in business. All shall form workers and professional unions, so that you may compete as a group with powerful outside interests. All shall, in order to withstand competition, merge with other businesses and form great cartels and multinationals. And your nations shall form vast trading blocks to successfully compete with other nations. All shalls only cooperate within a group in order that you may more successfully compete with or prevail over other groups. All shalls believe with your whole heart that a competitive world is natural. The law of defiance tells you so. The law of defiance tells you so. All shells as a worldwide corporate population compete with nature as if it were a malevolent force which must be dominated. All shells wage war and kill if necessary in order to protect prime financial interests, which is profit. All shells now recognize the basic collaborative nature of humanity.
Come gather around people wherever you roam, and admit that the water's around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the time they are a-changing. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. Gets hurt, or he who has stalled. The battle outside is raging. We'll soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the time they are a-changing. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend a hand, for the times they are a-changing. It is cast.